Let's see what the stew has for us today.
Welcome to the Gnomecast, Gnome Stew's tabletop gaming advice podcast. Here we talk with the other gnomes about gaming things to avoid becoming part of the stew, so I guess we'd better be good. This episode is brought to you by our awesome Patreon backers like the excellent Evan Harrison Cass, Hugo Martelacar, and Chaos Generators. This is Ange, and today we have a whole bunch of interviews from Gen Con. While John may be the chief gnome in charge, I'm the queen of the Gnomecast, and this time he's doing my bidding. Anyway, John was at Gen Con from August 2nd through the 6th and got to talk with a whole slew of amazing people. This one is going long, folks.
And we are here at the first day of Gen Con. Well, the first day for me, Thursday of Gen Con, and I am at one of my favorite places to eat, Lock Miller's Pub. And I also found somebody here who is also their favorite place to eat. Lorraine, correct?
Yes, correct.
Yes, hi, Lorraine. So you were up here, bellied up to the bar, and you, like, they all know you here. I'm a little
jealous. Yeah, they have. I've been here since it began in Indianapolis, and I've been there before when it was in Milwaukee and Racine, Wisconsin, so I've been going for quite a few years.
Yeah, you said you've been coming since 1983?
Yes, I have.
That is awesome.
And my kids, I have two kids, they've been going since I had them in my belly, and they're 26 and 30.
So what is the biggest thing that's changed over the years since it's been in Indy? Because, of course, changing from Milwaukee to Indy is totally different.
It's gotten huge, and the games have gotten more massive. I mean, there's so much to choose from. The only thing that you have to realize is when you want to get into these games, you better get in there really quick when they open up. Otherwise, you're not going to get in the game.
Yeah, yeah. No, there's a lot of like, oh, my God, hurry up and wait in here. But, you know, but you still get into games. You still
yes,
get into
I
things
do.
You enjoy.
All right. Yes,
what is the most fun thing you've played here?
I actually played Silent Death this morning.
Ooh.
Fantastic. I actually made it to 3-tier,
okay.
Which is good.
And that's a board game, RPG?
It's a board game.
Okay.
And they're from Ottawa, Canada, this group. They're the Red Shirts. And, I mean, it's fantastic. I've played this forever. And
nice.
I get in there. I like to kill them all. That's what you gotta do.
It is what you gotta do. Kill them all. That is the theme of Gen Con.
And they know who I am too. And they're like, God damn, Lorraine. Oh, sorry.
No, that's fine. All right. So if you come down to Gen Con, come to Lock Miller's and watch out for Lorraine. She is vicious.
Oh my God! Yeah, I will get you. Really good.
All right, we are here on Thursday of Gen Con at one of my favorite places, Lock Miller's Pub. It is pronounced Lock Miller's, and it is one of the best kept no longer secrets here in Gen Con. A great place to go get a beer or just hang out. And I'm here with Jameson, the bartender, here at Lock Miller's. So you work here normally. You work here during Gen Con. What's it like? How does it change from normal day to, wow, oh, my God, Gen Con rush?
Well, it's certainly all hands on deck. Don't expect to get a day off. Don't expect to leave early. Don't expect some of the perks that you get on kind of a slower day, time to sit down and eat lunch, that type of stuff. It's definitely a bit more fast-paced and keeps us on our toes. It's always good, though. It's always welcome.
So do you all dread it, or are you, like, you get excited for it, just handling all the tackle of, like, gamers coming in?
I generally look forward to it throughout the year. It's something that's a good money weekend for us, obviously. It's a chance to see familiar faces from the years before. And it's always a good time. By the end of the week, we're a little bit run down, but it's still always a good time. Always looking forward to it.
So, and if somebody shows up and they're not like, you know, oh, I'm not really a drinker, what's going on? What would you suggest to them?
Well, we have all kinds of good stuff. I mean, as far as non-alcoholic drinks go, we offer all kinds of great stuff. Sparkling lemonade's been a popular choice, and we have all kinds of different options, I suppose, and I try to accommodate whoever I can as best I can.
Awesome. Very cool. Well, you've got customers going down, so thank you very much.
Hey, no worries, dude.
Hello, it is Thursday here on Gen Con, and my voice is already going, but I am here with a less dressed up than usual Tony Law. I am used to Tony being in, like, phenomenally incredible clothing at the NAs, but, you know, you're kind of slumming it today, right?
Absolutely. I just didn't want to get dressed up. You're lucky I'm wearing pants.
I'm not wearing pants.
We know.
Yeah, everybody knows. Yeah, so how's Gen Con been so far? I mean, it's still early days.
Yeah, great so far. The floor wasn't as crowded as I thought it would be, but I know it's going to get a lot worse. So we pretty much got the stuff we wanted out of the way, and now we just get to look around and have fun.
Nice. Okay, now I caught you on your way to a game. What are you going to be playing?
War of the Dragon Masters. And to be honest, I don't remember what it's about. Because I signed up for it 6 months ago.
Dragons and Masters, and maybe they're having a war?
Maybe. That's my assumption. I'm hoping I get to ride a dragon.
Will you be disappointed if they're just having a tiff, something that could be, like, resolved through diplomacy?
I'll probably file a formal complaint.
Okay, that sounds like the best course of option.
Absolutely. It always works. It gets things done. A sternly worded letter.
Dragon bureaucracy.
Exactly.
All right, well, enjoy your game.
Thanks a lot.
All right, I am here outside of the IGDN room where a ton of people are inside playing games and having fun, and I have met Caleb Stokes, who has an Emmy-nominated game out there right now called Reg Markets. How are you doing, Caleb?
I am doing great. It is still weird to hear that, so I'm trying to, like, be cool with it and not freak out every time I hear it.
This is your first Emmy nomination,
yes,
right?
Definitely.
First of many.
Yes.
You're allowed to freak out. Freak out as much as you want.
It's gotten better, but it's still not great yet.
So do you have celebration plans if you win?
No, I highly doubt I will. I am extremely thrilled to be nominated, especially for Best Game. That's amazing. So I think I've already won in every regard that matters.
Well, and Reg Markets is quite an interesting game because it is about apocalypses, but the economic side of what happens when the world goes to shit.
Yes, we have a phrase in the book that post-apocalypse is privilege. Someone else's post-apocalypse is just the way you live. And there's a lot of that in horror gaming, like the woods in which the co-eds get murdered by the hill folk are just the place that other people hunt squirrel. And so it's very much about, it's a game of economic horror. It's a game about the horrors of capitalism. And we just threw some zombies on it there to keep it from getting too real.
It's the Star Trek, oh no, but they're zombies. So just, it's about zombies ostensibly.
Yeah. There we go.
Yeah, so what was the inspiration? What was the, like, oh, this is what I need to write?
I came of age. I got out of college during 2007, right as the housing crash happened. And as I started working on Reg Markets, I was underemployed. I had 14 jobs 1 year, just trying to scrape by. I'm also an educator, so I work in rural schools and deal a lot with the fallout of poverty. So, you know, I wanted to do the horror gaming that I loved, but I wanted it to be a little bit more real. And that's where most real horrors in my real-world life came from. Also, I find that no matter what campaign you're running in what system, any sufficiently long campaign eventually turns into the players trying to start a business. So I thought having actual rules for that, rather than just like having to tack something there on at the end, was good. Also, I am a Marxist, so I tend to view history that way. And I find the materialist assumptions of a lot of RPGs were like, the sword never needs sharpening and never breaks, and it always has like a consistent Walmart price even though you're existing in feudalism, a little absurd, and I don't think it does wonderful things to a narrative. So those all kind of combine to make Reg Markets.
Okay, awesome. Well, I wish you the best of luck, and let me ask this. What is the best thing happening in the game industry?
I think it's the diversification of the voices with professional groups like the IGDN and print on demand making it easier to get published than ever before. And actual play and online play, letting people find more groups than ever before. I think that's the general expansion of the hobby is the thing to be most excited about.
Very cool. Awesome. Well, I will see you at the Emmys on Friday night.
All right. Thank you very much.
All right. We are here outside the IGDN room again because that's where I'm doing most of my interviews. You're going to hear that a lot. But we're with Dave Chalker, who I know from blog competition throughout the past and Emmys and sharing drinks. Hello, Dave. How are you?
Good. I assume you're still sharing drinks with people.
I am sharing drinks with people. I don't know how much I should talk about that on the mics, but I mean, I will talk about that on the mics. Yeah. So how has Gen Con been so far?
It's been great. So on day one, I've been in the booth running demos of the Sentinel Comics role-playing game that I'm the lead designer on. And in previous years, we've just been playtesting in here because we actually haven't had a product to sell yet. And also, the game literally lived in the heads of like three or four people. And so there was limited amounts of people who could be tasked to run things. But now that part of it is out and people have been trained, I can be more of an ambassador than just one of the guys running demos here.
That is excellent. So I've been a fan of the Sentinels cooperative card game for a long time. Like, that was what we played. So what is it like to take something that already has a built-in rule set and turn it into something with a narrative game focus?
So we have some experience among the people working on the game adapting other properties to role-playing games. So many of us worked on the Marvel Heroic role-playing game before this, which, you know, was involved identifying what about Marvel makes the most sense in a role-playing game and other licensed properties. And so we wanted to take that approach, but instead of it being just here's comic books, here's characters, like what are some of the feels that people enjoy out of a card game that we can adapt to the role-playing game space.
So trying to emulate some of that same feeling and emotion that you get when playing that card game
exactly.
version of it.
So it's a very cooperative, it's a cooperative card game, but it also emphasizes teamwork as one of the main ways that you win. And we really wanted to get that sense of like playing combinations of things, but in a role-playing game. And in like the card game, it's like, okay, you shuffle a deck and you have this random hand and you can only do this move when it's in your hands. Well, that doesn't really work in a role-playing game because you're like, why wouldn't I have access to this thing? Otherwise, we had to come up with some ways to give that same effect and create interesting combinations among the different teammates and bring that to the role-playing game kind of mindset.
Okay. All right. So, you know, it's always hard to say exactly when something will drop, but if, like, Greater Than Games or Haka won't come and smack you down for saying it, can you guess at when this will be available for people?
So we have a starter kit for sale right now. It should be in game stores. We're selling it at Gen Con. You can order it direct from them. And that is a $20 product that contains six issues, which is what we call adventures, that are all like 2 to 3 hours each, six pre-gen characters, and how to play the game. So that is out right now. And then the number one question we end up getting is, when will we be able to make our own heroes? Because that is something that is very important to people. And we are going to have a core rulebook kickstarting in January of next year that will have all those rules for making your own heroes, designing your own villains, creating scenarios, advice, how to run the game, pages and pages of character creation tables that has been my life for like the past year or so. And the nice thing is we're super far along in that process, so it's not going to be like Kickstarter where you have to wait a long time to get in your hands. We will have a PDF available for people pretty much right away once that Kickstarter is done, so you won't have to wait a long time.
Very awesome. All right, well, it was great running into you here.
Yeah, you too.
All right, so on Interview Thursday, we have actually moved inside the IGDN room here because of bands playing outside. So I'm here with Brennan Taylor. Hello, Brennan. How are you?
Good. How are you doing?
I am doing well. So you're here at Gen Con, obviously, running games, doing stuff, mostly Bulldogs recently, and you just released a Bulldogs supplement, a new book, right?
I did, yeah. It's called People of the Zone. It's 40 different alien species for the game.
Nice. And aliens weren't really in the game. They were kind of there, but not like really well detailed.
There were 10 base species in the first in the core game.
But not to like an actual plank constant how many aliens would actually be out there.
Absolutely, right. So, yeah, no, it gives you tons more options, and lots of crazy stuff, fun stuff to play, like sentient funguses and swarms of insects with a hive mind, that sort of thing. So
nice. So how many Fungus Among Us jokes have been made once you do the sentient myconids?
Plenty.
Okay, awesome, good. I mean, I would expect that to spread. I mean, that's got good spore, to move forward.
That's right.
All right, so you've been doing the space sort of thing for a while. Of course, Blood Red Sands, that's another thing that like I very much like. Where do you go after Bulldogs? What are you doing next?
Well, we're working on right now is a samurai role-playing game called Thousand Arrows, which is uses Powered by the Apocalypse rules, set during the Warring States period of Japan, when everything had basically gone to shit and everybody was trying to take over. And so you're going to be playing powerful people in Japanese history trying to take control of the country, or at least trying to survive. So
okay. So, and with a name like Thousand Arrows, it's got to be Kurosawa inspired.
Oh, absolutely. Me and Mendez Hodes, who are the game designers, we had a Kurosawa weekend when we were starting our design process, where we both got movies that the other person hadn't seen and we binged them all weekend long.
How did Stray Dog get in here? That doesn't work for the samurai stuff. So can you in the game actually take 999 arrows and still survive?
I think you probably would have a real hard time with that, but you're going to have a dramatic death one way or the other.
And that is what samurai games are about, is a dramatic death.
Absolutely.
All right, so we're here at Gen Con. What is the best thing going on in the game industry right now? What do you think is the best thing that's happening?
Well, I mean, I'm going to be a little cliche about it, but I think the actual play podcasts are really something that I'm excited to see. I only discovered the Adventure Zone this last year and binged the whole thing, and just seeing it bringing new people into the hobby is something that I'm super excited about.
And are you doing any actual plays with you know, either Bulldogs or, you know, in preparation for Thousand Arrows?
I have not yet, but it's definitely something that's on my list. I have a big list, though.
Okay, awesome. Well, I look forward to hearing whatever character you are playing and how they gloriously die.
All right, awesome.
Thank you. All right, it is still Thursday. We're still doing interviews here, and I ran into Rich Howard doing a playtest of his game, Descent into Midnight. How are you doing, Rich?
I'm doing great, John. Thanks so much. We had a great time. We were having so much fun. We're doing playtests this weekend. I'm also doing running some games for Magpie. It's been fantastic. It's only Thursday. It's still an eye.
If somebody is not familiar with Descent into Midnight, yeah, give the elevator pitch, or should we say the underwater elevator pitch?
Yes, the hydrothermal pitch. Descent into Midnight is a Powered by the Apocalypse-style game that is, you are playing sentient underwater creatures on an alien world who live in a culture that has no human influence of any kind. It's an advanced civilization with their technology based on psionics and bioengineering. You are a team of guardians of this reef city who are trying to protect their city from an existential threat. So the threat can vary between Cthulhu level, something rising from the deep, to something obvious like, say, a pollution from another species on the land, or something really subtle like a psionic disease or something that's going through people and changing their culture.
Now, and we're not talking like bipedal Aquaman under the sea. We are talking, you are a manta ray sort of alien thing. You are more like an octopus or cephalopod.
Yes. No, you can literally play an octopus or a cephalopod. We designed the game specifically so we don't have races or species in this game. The races and species are built by the characters during character generation.
Nice.
So let me give you a few examples. One of my many favorites. I want to play, this is a player, I want to play a hive mind of psychically linked goldfish that live inside a jellyfish that's non-sentient, that we have a symbiotic relationship with, that we go around with, and when we breed, two of the goldfish leave, find another jellyfish, but they take 10% of the memories with them from generation to generation. I'm like, I can't come up with this. This is incredible. People, no matter how much marine biology anybody knows, everybody knows one really messed up, horrifying thing from some documentary they saw one time. And people will be like, oh yeah, there's this thing called an Aristotle's lantern. And people are like, what is that? And they're like, well, I just saw it on this thing this one time. And it's the way that like cute little sand dollars eat. It's like this horrifying bladed machine that grinds things to pieces. And they're just like, people are like, what? And they're all like, so we have this game where people are inadvertently teaching each other marine biology.
Nice.
At the same time that they're creating what we hope is an emotionally driven experience in playing something that's not human.
And so it's not hard to get them to make that jump to, wow, let's go to this very interesting underwater, different sort of physics,
yes,
different sort of like manipulation of the environment sort,
yeah,
of place.
Because they're immediately starting off with what, basically we're asking, what is the most interesting thing or horrifying thing about the ocean to you? And then they bring that in and either play it or they add it in the game. So they're really compelled. And then this idea of playing, I've been really complimented by the number of people we've had saying, I have never, ever played anything that wasn't humanoid, and I want to play this game over and over again. Like,
nice.
They're playing Leviathans, and one guy was like, I don't know anything about marine biology. He's like, can I play a walrus? And I'm like, you got it. He said, how about a walrus that holds its breath enough to be underwater for 24 hours? And he's like, that sounds great. And then he realized, wait, I'm the only one with air in my lungs? And I said, yes. And he's like, I play an underwater version of a flute that no one in the whole, no one in the city knows how to play, and it makes this haunting noise that no one can make. And I'm like the walrus wise person on the hillside. I'm like, this is awesome,
that
right?
Is
so
great.
It's a real true cooperative world building. It's a true. We had another group of people said, you know, we evolved because the Starship Enterprise crashed into the ocean and leaked dilithium crystals into the water, and that's how our culture came from. And they didn't use any of the technology, but that was the start of the game.
Well, so, there goes the prime directive.
I know, right? Exactly. Yeah. Good job, guys. Right.
Thanks, Voyager.
Yeah. Exactly. So, yeah, the world building is really cooperative. Everything's really cooperative. But it's really guiding people for me into getting them more interested and intrigued about marine life and about other things. But also putting yourself really in fully in the body of something that's not human and learn that that can have emotions and compassion and sentience as well.
That sounds awesome. I need to get into one of your off-book games that I always see you running sometime.
I'm running. We've got like 12 off-book games going this weekend between myself. We have Taylor Livingston's one of our artists. We have Taylor LeBresch, who's the designer from Leviathan Files, Richard Kreutzlander.
Taylor's also a gnome.
Yeah. And Brandon Leon Gambetta, who's written Pasión de las Pasiones and does some stuff for Magpie, is coming to help us out too. So it's a great team.
Well, very cool. Thanks for taking the time to do an interview.
Thanks so much.
All right, we are here at Gen Con, hopefully in a quieter hall than some of the other interviews have been in, with Brian Engard and Anna Mead. How are you guys doing today?
We're doing good.
Excellent.
Yeah. It's been a good day so far. Beginning of the con, but it looks like it'll be a good con.
Awesome. So what's the most interesting thing that's happened so far?
the will call line is really something else.
Yeah, well, it keeps getting bigger.
Yeah, it's like literally like 6 or 7 blocks long. Mm-hmm. It's ridiculous.
Hopefully I'll get my badge before the end of the con.
Right. I mean, we paid $100 for it. We should probably pick it up at some
point. Maybe
we
should have paid the $3 shipping.
Yeah.
$3 was $11.
Oh, well. $11?
Yeah.
It's still worth it.
That was probably why.
That's a bargain.
Yeah, I find that now. Past John made mistakes, but you know. Yeah. All right, so you all have a game out called Becoming, right? That is kind of an interesting focus. It's very narrative, but it's based on tragedy, right? Tell us about that.
So Becoming is actually, what's coming out now is the Ashcan for the second edition of Becoming. I actually released Becoming in 2013. Mm-hmm. And it's a game about tragedy and about what it costs to be a hero. That means that you have to find ways to make the game engaging, because it's not necessarily going to be fun, right? Like, bad things will happen to the hero constantly, and the ending is usually kind of a bummer. But people always come away. So, like, about the worst feedback that I've gotten is someone coming away going, like, this was great. Totally not my thing, though.
I mean, it's a game all about where you either couldn't save Gwen Stacy or Commissioner Stacy, depending on your narrative.
Right. Like, it's the way it's structured is you have one person who plays the hero, and then the other three people play fates. And they are like the classic Greek fates, Clotho, Atropos, and Lachesis, and they have roles that are sort of based on Greek mythology. They're a little bit like sort of co-GMs. Their job is to sort of push the hero and challenge the hero and do mean things to the hero.
Okay.
So, well, in a collaborative spirit.
That actually sounds much more fun. I just want to play one of the fates and mess with somebody. It sounds like a great game for that.
And the Ashcan for the second edition is for sale here at Gen Con, but it's going to be a PDF is going to go up on DriveThru after the con.
Yeah, it's at the IGDN booth.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, so what else are you working on other than the second edition of this?
Well, so Brian is the designer for Becoming. I was a creative consultant. I have an art history background, so his first edition was very different. This one we really focused on having the fates deeply involved, and I have a lot of mythology background, so we brought that in.
Yeah.
And I was a consultant on this, but he is definitely the designer.
Yeah. And if you see the art, it has this sort of like Gresham Earn feel to it, like it's black and red, very striking.
It's a stunning game.
But you asked what else we're working on.
Yes.
So it's not out of the con, but it's going out to Kickstarter backers now. Anna and I co-authored Uprising, the dystopian universe RPG, which is a fate-based RPG from Evil Hat that is based on the card games Coup, The Resistance, and One Night Revolution, and many others, because it keeps on producing
more.
From Indie Boards and Cards. So it's a fate game that is about revolution and betrayal. It is, as far as I know, the only fate game that features like an explicit betrayal mechanic.
Okay.
Which was hard, because fate doesn't support that super well. Out of the box.
It's a game about the resistance in a time when we need a little resistance.
Yeah.
So you can be whoever you are. It's a very diverse game. And fight
and
against
we're really proud of it.
Man.
We just got our comp copies like the day before Gen Con. Like I said, the Kickstarter backers should be getting them very soon, and it'll be for sale very soon.
So since there is a betrayal mechanic, you know going into it that you are going to be betrayed at some point. How does that change the way people approach?
Nobody trusts anyone else. You have to rely on each other because no one can overcome all the obstacles on their own. But, you know.
There's a great secrets mechanic, which was a really big deal with this game because it was something completely new for Fate. And it took us forever to go through all these iterations of a way to make it work, to keep secrets from each other at the table. It's very difficult. And we were really happy with what we ended up with. And the proof is in the pudding. I got approached today at a panel, and this guy was like, oh, I play tested it. I love the secrets mechanic.
Yeah.
So.
Very
like,
nice.
Like, basically, the way it works is you're sort of like incentivized with experience points, effectively, to do sneaky things. And whether you are a spy for the government or like a loyal resistance member, you have these things that will sort of look shady, even if they're not, that give you experience
right.
points.
You may not be guilty, but right. you look guilty.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Nice. So you're constantly looking at your fellow players and, like, is that the spy? That seems like something a spy would do. That person might be the spy. And then after the mission, you get a chance to accuse people.
Okay. So. Yeah, accuse.
Exactly. Yes, exactly. And it is actually, it's set in Paris.
Nice.
It's like cyberpunk Paris.
Oh, yeah. So that's a big deal because there are very few dystopian cyberpunk games that are set in an old world setting. And so cyberpunk
it's usually
Paris,
like Detroit or Tokyo or something
like that. A lot of the art in the book was influenced by famous paintings, so people who are into art will probably recognize
Yeah, like as you page through the book, you'll be like,
this seems
familiar. Yeah.
So. All right, so final question. What is the coolest thing that you think is going on in the gaming industry right now?
I think that we've been seeing like this sort of rapid democratization of game design, and that has led a lot of new voices into the industry who weren't there before and who have really interesting things to say. And we're seeing a lot of games that that are unlike anything we've seen before. At the Indie Groundbreaker Awards, Bluebeard's Bride won Game of the Year, and it I've never seen anything else quite like Bluebeard's Bride. It's really
And that's another one with very interesting, classically inspired art.
Right. And it's also another one that is fundamentally a tragedy.
Well, and written by three women.
Yeah.
And speaking as a newer voice in the industry, I've played as a gamer since I was in seventh grade, but as a newer designer, it is exciting to see more people of color, more LGBTQ, more women, people who identify as women. All of that in an industry which has always had a white male face, so it's exciting.
Yeah, it's an exciting time to be in the industry.
Very cool. Awesome. Well, thank you for speaking with me today.
Thank you.
All right, we are here in the IGDN booth with Aloy LaSanta. How are you doing, Aloy?
Oh my gosh, doing really well. It is already a long day. It's only Thursday.
It's only Thursday.
But I'm really excited. I have games to run. The games that have been run have gone really well so far. I have a really amazing team of GMs here that is helping me really promote Third Eye Games a lot. So it's pretty cool.
Yeah, I've met some of your GMs. I'm already trying to poach them for like my own projects.
They're wonderful too. Like that's the great thing. All of my GMs are friends. I actually brought a friend from Tampa to help me run games, but everyone before him, like all the other GMs besides him, are people who have GM'd for me in previous years because they played a game in a previous year and loved it so much, they're like, I'll run that game for you. So it's like, it's a cyclical thing. Like, it's just going to keep growing and growing the more people we run games for.
All right, so let's talk about that. Let's deviate completely from the script we just talked about 2 minutes ago. You have a lot of games. You do that stuff.
Yeah.
What is it like to set up and organize? If you were like some kid off the street going, oh, please, sir, give me an opportunity, what would they get like from you in terms of GMing? What should they expect?
Well, the biggest thing is that obviously you get them a badge. Like, right. That's a big deal. I usually give them adventures. I make sure that they have all the PDFs. I load everybody up on PDFs and GM screens and all kinds of stuff. And then usually at the end of the con, after Sunday, after the con has ended, I run a game for my GMs. Because it's actually really cool for like all of the GMs to run games for me, but I don't get to play with them. So I run a game on Sunday night after everybody's freaking exhausted, but I will run a game for them because that is the kind of person that I am.
That is very cool. That's kind of a cool end of the con tradition, you know? Like, I know like I've been out to dinners at the end of conventions and you've gone and seen people, but like sitting down and actually just having the chill post-con game is great.
And honestly, it's like, I ask my GMs to run at least three games, but the majority of my GMs are running four and five games because they just love the games and they want to help. So it's one of those sorts of things. So it's like, after you just ran five games, like, sometimes you just want to sit and play. You know, so I'm running five games, and I have a few others that are running five games. So it's like, I want to give back.
Okay, very cool. So who is your favorite GM who is standing within 5 feet of you right now?
Well, I mean, that would definitely be my friend Ed. He's here helping me run Part-Time God's Second Edition this year. It's not actually at the show. It'll be out in like a month or something. Dumb. Like, it's
because so you just finished the Kickstarter a little bit ago.
Exactly.
Right?
But honestly, it's like, it's kind of the new shiny, and the goal here was to run as many games as we can of it, get people super hyped and excited. Like, we're giving stuff away to people. It's amazing. Like, and that was all Ed's idea. So, like, there's a character who's a tattoo artist. Like, so we bought them, like, tattoo sleeves.
Nice.
So if you're playing that character, you get tattoo sleeves that you can put on and play so you can get into character.
Absolutely.
And it's, like, it's amazing. It's a great idea that I never thought of. So.
Very awesome. All right, so I got to ask this about Part-Time Second Edition.
Yeah.
Why did you feel the need to go to a second edition when it was so obviously nailed and perfect with Part-Time Gods of Fate, which I may or may not have worked on? No, I'm joking.
No, because it
Part-time it's a different beast.
The Part-Time Gods of Fate was actually an amazing translation of the game over into the Fate engine, and I think that the Encoded team did a really good job with that, which is why they're actually going to continue that, and it's going to be fun, so it's going to be running alongside Second Edition. For me, a Second Edition was kind of important because I went back to the First Edition about a year ago, and I was like, I'm going to run this at a con, and I ran it, and I was like, this just doesn't feel right. Anymore.
Your more nuanced ideas.
Exactly.
Just didn't fit up as
it just didn't. It just wasn't me anymore. Like, I've just evolved, game design wise, and what I want out of it. So I was like, back to the drawing board. Let's make it a new thing.
And so, what are the biggest changes you made between the first edition and the second edition?
The biggest ones, because a lot of the themes and the setting and all that stuff are the same. A lot of the character choices are the same, but I really kind of narrowed the focus into those choices. So instead of like, hey, you have a job and then you're also a god, it's like, well, you're also picking like your personality and you're also picking like what you're god of, and you get like good, there's good and bad that goes along with those things. The biggest thing, I think, though, is the addition of a free time and wealth. Good. There's actually a free time and wealth mechanic, because in first edition, we talked a lot about how every so often your personal life is going to come and invade. But what I did is I mechanized that. So you have a free time score that's basically your own personal countdown clock to when something is going to come mess with you. And it's amazing. And it works so well in the whole scheme of it. It fits the game and it makes it more engaging and just makes it way more fun. It makes it fit more of what I really wanted in the first place.
Right.
So.
All right. So last question then.
Yeah.
If you were statting yourself up as a character in this, what would your free time score be?
My free time? Probably like a two.
Probably like
a two. It's like out of 10.
Out of 10.
So it'd probably be like a two.
So things would be just messing with you all the time.
Yeah.
That sounds about right. All right. Thank you so much for doing the interview.
Thank you so
much. We should do lunch sometime.
We should.
that should be good.
Good morning. We are here on Saturday of Gen Con. Hopefully all the audio problems from Thursday have been fixed. And we are with Craig Campbell, who is in the IGDN, has just produced Capers. I've seen some of the proofing copies of that. And you are here. This is your first Gen Con as an exhibitor. How does it feel?
Yeah, I'm a publisher, and I'm at Gen Con. And it's all business expense and deductible. it's crazy. It's a different mindset. You know, I'm having fun, but it's a different kind of fun because I'm also thinking of it in terms of business and what I can do and how I can support the IGDN, and I'm pointing people to other games, and pointing, you know, talking more about my games and kind of just having this, like, I'm a designer and publisher and talking about that side of the industry rather than just telling people the stories about, like, you know, I played this cool paladin.
Well, you said you used to live in Milwaukee, so you have been going to Gen Con for a while, even when it was back in Milwaukee.
Yeah,
right?
When I went to school in Milwaukee at UW-Milwaukee, it was great because I didn't have to get a hotel or anything like that. I could just pop down there. There's plenty of times I did just one day because it was easy. You didn't have to make a big commitment. And then, you know, I did multiple days too. And then I've gone here in Indy a handful of times, but it's been a few years since I went. And in that interim, I've, you know, published a game and I've got a second one that's coming in a couple months. So I'm like in that weird headspace of it's not just me playing, but it's me like being a part of promoting the industry.
So what is your coolest moment as an exhibitor here? Like, you know, people coming up and talking to you about your game?
there was some of that. I made sure to let all the Capers backers know that I was going to be at the Indie Game Developer Network booth on Thursday all day.
Nice plug.
Yes. And, you know, to say, you know, like, I'm going to have the Capers book, the proof copy, which is like the nearly complete version of the game, with everything laid out and all the illustrations in it and everything. And so I had, you know, I had a handful of backers that stopped by and said, hey, I just wanted to stop by real quick, meet you, say I love, you know, I'm looking forward to the game. Where's that Capers book? I want to see what it looks like. To get that little preview.
Very awesome. All right, so last question I'm asking as many people as I can. What is the coolest thing happening in the industry right now?
I think one of the most interesting thing that happened here was we saw the release of Harlem Unbound. It won a few Ennies last night. Congratulations to Chris Spivey and team. And it's, you know, it's a supplement to Call of Cthulhu that addresses something that happened, you know, that is part of the world of the 1920s and 30s, that is racism, that is often swept aside for the sake of just escapism fun in a lot of games, where we don't want to think too much about how much of a racist H.P. Lovecraft really was, and we just say, well, we're not going to talk about that. We're just going to let, you know, big monsters happen. And, you know, Chris and team created a game supplement that addresses that and doesn't shy away from it and lets it be part of the world and live and breathe on its own. And so it's not necessarily a game that's for everybody, but for those people that wanted to see that happen, it's... you know, it quite possibly, the word might be revolutionary on that front. So it's really cool to see something like that happen, because I think we'll see a few other people down the road in the next couple of years, like, take some taboo subjects that otherwise gamers sometimes don't want to deal with, and just like, well, we'll give this to the people who want to see that.
Well, and treating it in a way that, one of the things I'm most impressed by Harlem Unbound about is, you know, Chris Grazin says, yeah, this is tough to talk about. Here's how you do that. Here's how you work through those conversations at the table. And I think that's a really awesome thing to do in any kind of game.
It's a thoughtful game book.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you for taking some time this very early morning to come and talk to me.
You're welcome.
Hello, Radio Voice. All right. We are sitting here with James and Tricasso. We've just run into him here while having morning coffee and talking to Craig. And, yeah, how are you doing today? And also, don't blame me for doing podcasting badly, because I'm not as good at it as you are.
I disagree. I think you are wonderful at podcasting. I'm doing great. It's Saturday of Gen Con, and I'm tired.
No, we all get enough sleep and don't stay up too late and then hang out with people on Fridays. That doesn't happen.
No, not at all. Not at all. Yeah.
So how is your Gen Con so far? What have you been doing here?
So a lot of awesome stuff has been happening. I always try to play games that I haven't played, which has been really great. I've tried a lot of OSR stuff because I'm here with an OSR fan, and it's an area of the game that I'm not super familiar with, and that's been really fun. Died a lot.
That sounds like OSR.
Yeah, exactly. And I've had a couple of exciting announcements here, probably the biggest of which is Burn Bright, the RPG that Jim McClure, Cat Cole, Darcy Ross, and myself developed for Roll20. So that has not been released yet, but is going to be in playtest soon for Roll20 subscribers.
Very nice. I don't think that's even been officially announced yet, so I could totally scoop you on everything. I could release this right now.
Yeah, you could totally scoop us. It's a science fiction role-playing game that takes place in, I guess, the future. You can't really be a human, so it's unclear if it's an alternate universe or whatever. But essentially, when we sat down to design the game, we were like, man, exploration systems are hard to make. Let's restrict this to one galaxy that is shrinking. And so we came up with this idea.
Oh, one galaxy. That's manageable, one galaxy.
Yeah, just a single galaxy. But you see, the galaxy is ever shrinking. So it's really one very small galaxy that's getting smaller. Because the idea is we're towards the end of the world, where the Big Bang has turned into the Big Shrink. And now the universe is receding slowly, and there is this phenomenon called the burn that is at the edge of this galaxy and closing in and swallowing planets, and people who are taken by the burn, this sort of aurora borealis thing, are never heard from again.
Wow.
And so there's famine and there's panic and there's war as people are trying to compete for the resources that are disappearing.
So is this sort of like a, man, this is happening and that planet was there yesterday, or is it like, well, this planet has 100 years left?
So the burn, it moves erratically. Sometimes it pauses. Sometimes one edge of it will close in while the others are static. So no place is safe, but they think that what is right now the center of the universe probably has about 500 years left. So there's still time. There's still going to be generations after you, which leaves things worth fighting for.
Nice. Very cool. All right. So let me ask a question I've been asking as many people as I can. What is the coolest thing happening in the industry right now?
So the coolest thing happening right now in the industry is the number of new players that are coming to bear. Obviously, we've all heard reports that 5th edition is having one of the best years ever. I think role-playing games itself is having a really great time, and we're attracting a lot of people who are not in the same demographic as you or me or Craig Campbell. You know, we're seeing a lot of people of color, people who are not men coming to this gaming platform and writing games and creating stuff that is really has this creative boom and is making me think about role-playing games in totally different ways. And I think bringing new people into the hobby is important for the longevity, but also so the hobby doesn't become stagnant, so we're not just making D&D clones over and over again.
Yeah. Right? No, and that's awesome, and I think, like, right now, this is sort of the reaping what has been sown for the last 10 years as people have started pushing for this and then figuring out how to do it and, you know, kind of getting that momentum going. And it's awesome to see it happening, you know, the revolution occurring right here.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, a lot of that has to do with people streaming their games. I think that makes it more accessible, right, and podcasts and stuff like that. Tooting my own podcast horn, of course. But, yeah, I mean, I think that is huge for this market. And then a lot of other contributing factors, one being that the community itself has become more welcoming, more open arms, and as we invite more people who are different in, the community becomes more different because then people see someone like themselves there, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, awesome. Thank you for sitting down to talk with me, and I will let you go off and get some coffee now, which I'm going to do too.
Thank you so much, John.
Good morning. We are here on Saturday morning of Gen Con post Ennies with Chris Spivey, who pretty much swept the Ennies. Walk around and let him clink a bit. There's your multiple Ennies. How are you doing this morning, Chris?
Good. Feeling a little tired, but still really excited about the win. Wins. I like
yeah.
that sound.
Yeah, it's good. It's a good sound. It wears well on you. Yeah, you were up. I had one drink with you last night to celebrate, and then you were up for much, much longer hanging out with the crowd.
I may have seen the morning light at around 4:30 or 5, and then crashed out for 2 hours to get back up to start running around again.
So you're working on 2 hours today, on Saturday, on 2 hours.
Yeah. Yes, but I don't feel tired yet. It's just the energy is still there.
Are you running a lot of games? Do a lot of boost stuff? Or
I've actually got a distributor, IPR, sort of the independent press revolution is carrying all the books, but they're already sold out.
Okay.
Otherwise, I've run a couple games, I won a couple panels, and I'm doing a slew of sci-fi chats for a science fiction line that I'm going to be producing for Chaosium.
Nice, very nice. All right, so if people are not familiar, what did you win all the Ennies for?
A little book called Harlem Unbound.
Which is phenomenal. We have reviewed it on Gnome Stew.
It's basically taking all the Lovecraftian tropes and his racism and flipping them on their head by having all of your protagonists be African-American, LGBTQ, immigrants from other countries, and setting them during the Harlem Renaissance that was a movement about change. And that is something that we need now in current time more than ever.
Absolutely. And it has been wonderfully received. If, you know, if you're listening to this podcast, every other person has said, like, oh, all this great work that's being done, mostly by Chris Spivey with Harlem Unbound, because that is the big thing that's really saying, I think, what needs to be said and addressing it frankly.
And the book has a lot of personal meaning to me in addition to that, that my cousin Zora Neale Hurston, and I sort of actually named my daughter for her, and the book is in tribute to both of them.
Very nice. Did you expect it to be so well received here? Were you kind of like, you know it's there, hopefully it'll hit, or were you like, oh, it'll be a footnote?
No, I expected to have a slew of trolls trying to burn down my door.
Yeah, and have you had that yet?
No.
Okay, that's good.
The few trolls that I have had sort of come after me online all comment about it is so well written, but we just don't like this one thing.
So they're polite trolls?
So they're baby trolls.
Okay, baby trolls, yeah. All right, so talk about your stuff. You've got a lot going on. What is the best thing going on in the industry right now? What is the best thing that's happening in the industry?
The fact that it looks like it's starting to change. That there's going to be more opportunities for other diverse voices to come up and do something. For instance, I've got Harlem Unbound going out, and it's rocking everything right now. I know that New Agenda Publishing is coming out, and they've got their own sci-fi book. I also know that Mark Diaz Truman's got Cartel that's dropping. And there's so many other people, even like Bluebeard's Bride, that's an exceptional piece of work. And all of those are being received, people are seeing it, and they're starting, they should have already have understood it's here, but now they're actually having to acknowledge it.
These games are tackling directly that kind of social change and what needs to happen rather than just kind of being something in the fringes.
Yes.
Yeah. Very awesome. Well, thank you for taking some time this morning to talk to me, and I look forward to going and playing with my copy of Harlan Unbound that I bought before it sold out because I knew that was going to happen.
Awesome. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
And hello, we are here on Saturday of Gen Con. Happened to run into Derek Knutson-Fry and Daniel Knutson-Fry in the hallways here. So we're going to talk about, you guys are working on the second edition, just came out at Origins, of the Universal Storytelling System, right?
That is correct. Hello, thank you for having us.
Hi, John. Thanks for having us.
Thanks for being here.
We just released a second edition rule set of the Universal Storytelling System. It's been out in one form or another for, I would say, 6 or 7 years now, and I feel like this system is now, I feel like first edition and revised were like alpha beta, and this is like the first real release edition. I feel like everything is really now clicking as far as the rule set is concerned.
Getting your feet under you, testing it out through the first one, then coming back and redoing and saying, yes, this is what we could have done.
Yes, exactly. A lot of it was a combat. I absolutely despise writing combat rules because they're so wonky, because it takes everything out of, it's like playing a mini game in a RPG. It's like, okay, now we're going to play this wonky card game, and then, yeah, but it's a role-playing game. You're going to have combat somewhere along the line, so I feel like now everything is clicking, and the system is very much, I designed it like a toolbox where it's very modular. So if you pick up the book, it's really thin. It's like literally like maybe a quarter of an inch thick, but that's because it's just rules. It's no setting, nothing. I mean, it is just, you can use any type of genre with it. I've run sci-fi, I've run Western, I've run post-apocalyptic, we're running here at Gen Con. But each of those settings has their own rules to augment the core rules.
I have to say, this is all making me so mad because it's everything that I'm working on. You're just like months ahead of me in the cycle. I'm like, that's exactly how I was going to do a system like that. But no, it's awesome. I think there need to be more things like that out there. So yeah. I'm really glad you're working on it.
Thank you.
And you have a Kickstarter going right now for a module, right?
That's correct.
Second. And that's something you wrote, correct, Dan?
Yes. It's called Flower of Heaven. I started playing D&D when I was a kid. I was about 13. Played through, and basically it's part of a setting world that I started when I was a kid. And I'm older, and I had actually run a kind of a one-off campaign, and some friends of ours played it, and Derek approached me and says, well, why don't we take part of your story and put it into my setting, and let's see how it works. And so I wrote the module, we played through it, and it is really cool to see something that I've done, you know, actually come to life. So having it set as the module, this first module, it's in the Kickstarter right now. There will be two more modules, which will complete a whole section of the story. And doing it on his system, it was a little rough for me at first, but actually sitting down, well, because I was used to...
Because this is the first thing you've written that's getting published.
Yes. I've wrote forever, but I never honestly thought that what I wrote was that good enough for people to see.
That's a common story.
Yeah, so, but everybody seemed to like it, and I am absolutely stoked about watching something that I've done, you know, come to life. And it works so well with his system, and I wasn't sure if it would, and after playing it, it works. His system is amazing because it allows me the freedom to actually do a little more, even, and still leave it open-ended for people to play.
Very awesome. All right. So what would people search for if they're looking for the Kickstarter for this, which ends August 14th?
August 14th is when it ends, and you're going to be looking for Flower of Heaven. That will get you to the Kickstarter. We have the layout all done. So what we're really funding is cover art. as well as the printing process. The printing is always just an enormous
ridiculously
expense.
Ridiculously expensive.
Seriously. And we want to do this in color because the layout artist just did a fantastic job. It looks like it's all Asian. There's like pagodas and mountains and
the koi fish. The gentleman who did the layout had made some suggestions that even I hadn't thought of. And when you look at it, just from the layout that we have so far, even without the cover, it looks like something you would see in a antique Asian setting of looking in a book. The old water block paintings that the Japanese do, the water paintings that the Chinese... It's amazing because it looks like something you would find. Like you just walked in somewhere and found an old book. So it looks really good.
Awesome. Well, thank you guys so much.
Thank you very much. Yep.
All right. We are here at the IGDN booth. There's probably a lot of background noise because there are a lot of people in the booth, as there should be. I'm not biased and a member of the IGDN at all. But we ran into Jacob McIntyre, who is one part of the team working on Beyonder. So yes. How are you doing today, Jacob?
I'm doing fantastic today. How are you doing today, John?
I am doing good. We're working through the energy lows with lots of coffee.
Yes, that sounds about right.
Yeah. So Beyonder is a really kind of interesting... I looked through the art for this, and it is beautiful. It is just a phenomenal-looking setting. But tell me about the setting. What is the setting like? What makes it unique?
So the setting is... It's almost a scientific twist on fantasy. It's what we think Tolkien might have written if he had been a physicist instead of a historian and a linguist.
That is awesome.
So the world comprises these six primal energies, and you essentially play as a channel who is a scientist who has the power to manipulate these energies. The scientists, the channels, form these guilds, which are six giant organizations. They have this like geopolitical clout and sway that kind of span the entire continent of Tamara, where everything takes place.
So there's a lot of focus on kind of the interplay and politics and how everything comes together, rather than in traditional fantasy where it's, you know, oh, here's this race and here's how it works. Here's how orcs and dwarves have an issue with each other.
So we like to have the races have a bit more leeway than that. None of us like the idea of, like, I am a dwarf and I drink beer and I have a big beard, ho ho ho.
I noticed you went right to the Scottish accent for the dwarf.
Yeah, because, like, everybody does that. Yeah. And, you know, that's fine. Like, there's nothing wrong with that. But there's a lot of diversity and variation within each race. There's plenty of room for characters to sort of differentiate from the norms set for their race. We even have, in our book, we have descriptions of the races, and there's a part where one of the races is called, like, big of heart, but less intelligent. And there's a call-out from a commentator that says, that's racist. That's not true. There are a lot of eminent scholars that are Ushen.
And that's in-world, though.
Yeah,
that's
absolutely.
That's very cool. Yeah.
So the world is rich, involves, and there is room for that more sort of, like, here is my race, here is my class, this is the fantasy setting I'm going to play. But it happens within a world that has a lot of variation within it.
Awesome. So what all is out right now for Beyonder? What all can people get?
So we have two books out right now. We have Beyonder, Science of the Six, which is our core rulebook. We also have Imbelni's Bestiary, being a traveler's account of Tamara and her creatures, which is an in-game book written by Imbelni Ulawe, but it is also our bestiary.
Nice.
It has about 60 creatures, yeah.
Very cool.
And we are going to be releasing another book sometime soon. We have a Kickstarter planned, so if you are listening to this and you're interested, please come check out our website and get subscribed to our newsletter or follow us on Facebook. We're happy to inform you about it.
Awesome. Very cool. Well, thank you so much for stopping for the interview.
Yeah, thanks so much, John.
All right, I am here at the IGDN booth again, and now for the completely biased portion of the podcast interviews, because I am a member of the IGDN. I've been hanging around the IGDN booth a lot, but somebody who has been here far more than I have and who has been listening to all of the various things coming out of our booth and other people's booths is Nicole Liberty. Hello, Nicole. How are you?
Doing well, John. How about yourself?
Doing good for Saturday at Gen Con. How is it in the chaos of the booth?
Well, nice and steady. So it's Saturday, so it's always the busiest day, right? So lots of people, lots of folks having already played games, finding out what they love, what they want to try, what they want to pick up. And that's what we're getting today, which is fantastic.
Very awesome. Yeah, I can barely move about in here trying to get from place to place with people in it, and that's really awesome. So, you know, IGDN, if you don't know, is the Independent Game Developers Network, and it's just a collection of people coming together to promote and work on and share resources and do good things in the industry. And you've been here running the booth all this time. What has been flying off the shelves? What have people been looking at?
We've been really lucky this year. We had a lot of Annie nominees, about six or so, and
nice.
So we sold out of Happiest Apocalypse.
Excellent.
That went. Of course, all of our Metal Weave stock is always going to fly off the shelves because they're gorgeous. We've got Dream Chaser. Beyonder is one of our new members, and they've been demoing today. So we've been selling a lot of their book, and they're just gorgeous art. So we've sold a lot of family games, a little bit of horror. Always selling RPGs, right?
I love that. Family games, horror, the same thing at once. Family
horror.
Pretty much,
often. And we have a couple games that fit that, too.
Yes, awesome. Well, thank you for taking a minute to talk to me today.
Sounds great. Thanks, John, for coming in.
All right, still Saturday here at Gen Con, and I'm walking through the halls, and I see somebody sitting on the ground playing with a really awesome kind of gridded system, and I run into Wayne Johnson of, you said, Battleboard?
Battleboard Games.
Battleboard Games. All right, so describe to me, for our audio audience, what we're actually looking at.
Well, what I figured out was that pegboards use the same one-inch grid that most other game systems use, and I created a series of game terrain pieces that snap to a pegboard. Each one of the pieces can be aligned in anything from hallways. We've got doors, staircases, a variety of angled pieces, and even some floor pieces that snap in with things like barrels or chests and things like that.
So you should really go to Battleboard Games and look at this and see what these look like. But let me try to describe them for you. It's a small, 4-inch by 4-inch piece that looks like dungeon walls. It has like a kind of brickstone pattern on the side. On the top, it has a large pattern, each with like about an inch kind of block on each of the tops. But then on the bottom are nine little pegs that just fit into the holes on the pegboard and make a really nice, secure holding. And then there are corner pieces, stairs, a little terrain piece, doors that come out that sit in. This is very nice for your dungeon crawls, and it feels weighty. It looks weighty. It's got some presence to it here.
Yeah, some strength to it, but remarkably pretty light. A whole shoebox of 70 pieces weighs less than a player's handbook.
And he just picked up the pegboard and kind of like held it at an angle, and everything is still sticking on here. This is a very nice little product. And now this was on Kickstarter.
Yeah, just recently, in the month of June, we had a successful Kickstarter launch. It worked out pretty well, and we're in the process of having the parts plastic injection molded. What you're seeing here are 3D printed components.
And can people go and get it on the backer kit still, add on to it, or do they have to kind of wait until it gets through and then go pick it up once you've got a store set up and are get it through distribution?
The parts will become available in October. We're looking at opening up the door to pre-orders probably in August or September. But for the most part, October is when we're likely to see everything released.
This is very awesome. All right, well, I will just conclude this interview by mugging you and taking it with me.
I understand.
All right, thank you.
My third set this week.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, we are still at Saturday on Gen Con. I'm still wandering the halls, finding people and talking to them. And I, amazingly enough, again, ran into another game developer somehow. But today we have Tristan Zimmerman here, who you're running Molten Sulfur blog, which does not actually say what the blog is about. So why don't you tell people? Because that is not what you'd think it's about if you just looked at the title.
Sure. So what the Molten Sulfur blog does is it's weekly free gaming content drawn from the real world, from real history, real folklore. We kind of give you the rundown on the real stuff, the real history, the getting into the level, not necessarily into the nitty-gritty. We give you all the information that you as the GM need to run something based on this real phenomenon or this real event, and make it fun and interesting and engaging and really reach out and grab your players, but not necessarily this real profound level of detail, because that's never going to come up. It's never really going to get used at the gaming table.
No, 16th century peasants wore hats like this, not like that.
Exactly. Unless, of course, it's relevant to some sort of plot hook or something, in which case, heck yeah, let's go into detail, but only if it's cool and interesting and relevant.
Right, so you're focusing on things that would actually come up in the actual play experience for people, so they feel supported but not overwhelmed.
Exactly.
Okay, that's cool. So why Molten Sulfur, then?
Oh, geez. It
says the guy who runs Gnome Stew.
Yeah. Lots of boiling gnomes over there. It's colorful. It's colorful. It's real. And honestly, I was standing on a train station and a big train car went rolling by that said, caution, molten sulfur. I said, yeah, that sounds pretty cool. I'll roll with that.
Awesome. That's really good. I like that. All right. So what is the most interesting thing you've written up recently, like in the last month or so?
Oh, geez. So interesting's a bit of a loaded question. One thing that I wrote up recently that I'm going to be dropping here in the next couple of months. I have a big, long backlog. I'm a big believer in that. A piece about a particular cargo cult in northeastern New Guinea in the late 1940s. We kind of have these ideas about, if you know the term cargo cult, you probably imagine, like, you know, oh, clearing an airstrip in the jungle and building a fake aircraft control tower and whatever. But cargo cults, really, they came in an enormous variety of different styles. They were tied into local indigenous religious practices in really interesting ways, and they were mostly kind of self-contained. They weren't developed from each other. They sprung up de novo. So each one is very different and very colorful and very interesting. And so talking about this particular cargo cult, and for those who don't know, the kind of central idea behind a cargo cult is in Melanesia, in the South Pacific during World War II, and even before that, you had people who were, you know, Stone Age level of technology, and all of a sudden you see these ships rolling in and these aircraft going overhead delivering enormous quantities of material that you've never seen before in your life. And, well, clearly, you know, oh, well, we have our religious traditions that we use to ensure good harvests and things like that. Obviously, these guys we've never met before have their own religious traditions that give them all this stuff. So if we can just figure out the right rituals, we'll get this stuff too. And they're all interesting. They're all fascinating. So writing up, you know, one particular manifestation. And then the key is, how do you integrate that into your game? You've got this cool plot hook. You've got this cool bit of real history and, for that matter, real religion. But how do you take that and how do you put that into your game? So real plot hooks ready to drop into virtually any campaign setting, any kind of game, tensions that that you can manipulate as a GM in order to make memorable sessions. That's what it's all about. It's all about the play experience, ultimately.
That sounds very cool. And that's always what's kind of missing as a game master. Like, oh yeah, I've got this idea. I know the general concept, or I've heard Cargo Cult. But how do I play that out? Where's the stuff I need? How would that work? What sort of things are in there? You know, and even just having that plot hook and a little definition really helps you kind of move it along into your setting. Mm-hmm. Well, that sounds very awesome. So I'm going to be going to check out Molten Sulfur blog with caution, because it's caution, molten sulfur.
Indeed. And that's at moltensulfur.com.
Awesome. Thank you very much, Tristan.
My pleasure. Thank you.
All right, coming back on Saturday again, and I am just wandering through the halls and meeting people, and I see Jacqueline Brick.
Hello.
Are you doing, Jacqueline?
I'm doing well. I am exhausted. It's the third day of Gen Con, fourth day if you count day zero, which I do. But yeah, no, it's been busy.
Excellent. Yeah, it is certainly like bustling around here, and it is a lot of people around, and it makes for a very interesting situation. But
definitely does.
So the thing that I know that you have done that is releasing here at Gen Con is Vampire the Masquerade, the 5th mm-hmm. edition, and you had what I'm going to say is probably one of the most important parts of a game like that, because this is important, but you wrote a lot of the safety rules in Vampire.
So, Vampire the Masquerade was slotted to come out on August 2nd, and as you all know, there was a blog that decided to write an article taking some of the problems that White Wolf had and extrapolating them and blowing them up beyond all reason, essentially flat out stating that White Wolf are crypto-fascists, that they have Nazi imagery embedded into their game, that they're secretly trying to turn people into Nazis through Vampire 5th Edition, and while Vampire can be tone-deaf at times, I genuinely do not believe that is the case. And so I was approached by Jason Carl and Matthew Dawkins of White Wolf, and they said, hey, Jax, because that is my nickname, we need someone to write the safety rules for this game in a week, and we will pay you. And I was like, okay. So I turned out something in 48 hours and handed it to them because they were very clear about what they wanted, which is awesome, because for something like safety rules, you need to be very, very you need to be very clear with what you want, because if I'm writing you safety rules, it needs to, where is the game weak? Where could players fall out of the game? You know, what in the game could damage the players? And then structuring rules around that.
Well, and especially with the game, anything that delves into deeper topics, more, you know, this is the dark side of the human experience,
yep.
It's important to set boundaries, to have safety, to make sure things are
definitely
are there. So what kind of safety rules did you write for this, for the vampire sort of subjects they attack?
Along with my usual recommendations, some of my favorite recommendations for safety rules, and these are pretty widely available, are Lines and Veils by Ron Edwards, The X Card by John Stavropoulos, Safety Signals from Games to Gather, which is a Portland group, Fade to Black, which is a favorite of many groups I've been in, and stuff like that. But I also wrote essays on how to deal with disability and transness at your table, which I actually had sensitivity read by a trans disabled friend of mine, Anna Mardall, and I paid Zer and made sure that they knew, you know, what they were getting into, and that was very awesome of them to make sure that I was handling that properly. I wrote an essay on how to incorporate fascism into your game, because I have a degree in international relations, so this is actually a topic that is very close to my heart. And one thing that Jason Carl and I agreed on is that fascism has its place in the World of Darkness, because the World of Darkness is our world, but darker. And if we didn't have fascism in the World of Darkness, it would actually be a lot lighter hearted than our current world. And that's not really the tone we're going for, because the idea behind the World of Darkness, like so many other horror games, is to explore the darker side of the human experience, and then in doing so, learn how to deal with it in your own life. I also wrote an essay on how vampires, basically since the novel The Vampire by John Polidori, who was a close friend of Lord Byron's and definitely didn't use him as an inspiration, vampires are predators. Vampires are sexual predators, specifically, and feeding scenes in Vampire the Masquerade, really in any vampire game, are akin to sex, whether consensual or non-consensual. So I wrote an essay on how to deal with sexual assault and sexual predation in your vampire game, because that's a really important topic that a lot of GMs don't really think about, because I like to say that the sort of people who play vampire are the sort of people who play vampire, and that's kind of one of my big issues with a lot of vampire players, is a lot of vampire players just want to do the whole power play thing and don't really want to get into the deeper aspects. And it's okay to play out a power fantasy with vampire, but you have to be willing to admit out of game that, you know, you are playing a chaotic evil or a neutral evil power fantasy, right?
Yeah, you're doing this thing, you're engaging a darker side, but that means you need to put more boundaries along to eject out of it when it is not appropriate.
Or too much.
Right.
So one of the weirder aspects of writing safety rules is when a lot of people found out that White Wolf had safety rules, I got a lot of comments of, can I talk you out of writing for White Wolf because they're terrible? Or, you really shouldn't be supporting White Wolf, they're too problematic. And I think that as somebody who is writing these rules, it's important, it's even more important to have safety rules in a game that could be problematic, because safety rules, as I've said in tweets, are not there to virtue signal. They're not there to make a perfect game better. They are there to protect you if something comes up. And they're totally optional, and they're not hand-holding or anything. And something that should be very clear when you are writing safety rules is that people can choose to use them or not use them. But if you're including safety rules and somebody uses them, it's really important to respect the sacredness of that safety rule just as much as you would respect the sacredness of a dice roll.
Right. And it's about respect for the people at
yeah,
the table.
Definitely.
And saying, yes, I'm going to make a safe space for you, the same that I would want for me.
Definitely, yes. Yeah.
Awesome. Well, thank you for sitting down and talking with us about these. This is a super important subject.
Yeah, this is something I don't think enough creators are into. I know a lot of creators who do include safety rules in their game, and that's awesome. I'm so happy that John Stavropoulos' X card is so widespread.
It took off.
Yeah, no, it's amazing because it's so simple, right? You just hit the X card, or you say X card, or you say I'm going to X card this, or whatever. And I think it's a great starting point, but one of the reasons I include other safety rules in games I write is because the X card can sometimes put the onus on someone who may not want to express that they're uncomfortable, And having check-in mechanics for other people, such as the OK check-in, which I also include, or support signals, also gives sort of space for people to check in on other people who might be showing signs of discomfort but aren't doing anything about it.
Right. Awesome. Well, thank you for sitting down and talking with us.
Yeah, sure.
Thank you so much to John and all the interviewees for taking the time to chat with him, including Gen Con veteran Lorraine, Locke Miller's Pub bartender Jameson, former Annie Awards business manager Tony Law, Caleb Stokes of Hebanon Games, Dave the Game Chalker of Critical Hit Studios, Brennan Taylor of Galileo Games, game designer and blogger Rich Howard, I know him, Brian Engard and Anna Mead of Blue Gables Publishing and Consulting, Eloy LaSanta of Third Eye Games, Craig Campbell of Nerdburger Games, James Intricasso of World Builder Blog and the Don't Split the Podcast Network, Chris Spivey of Darker Hue Studios, Derek and Daniel Knudsen Fry of Pale Gain Press, Jacob McIntyre of Flying Nightbear Games, Nicole Liberty from the IGDN booth, Wayne Johnson of Battleboard Games, Tristan Zimmerman of Molten Sulfur Blog, game designer and LARPwrite Jacqueline Brick. Seriously, folks, check out the links in the show notes. I know most folks ignore the show notes, but this time there's a wealth of information in there leading you to some amazing people. Finally, before we get out of here from this astoundingly meaty version of the Gnomecast, all of us gnomes want to give a heartfelt thank you to our readers and everyone who voted for us in the Annie Awards. We do what we do for you, and winning the gold Annie tells us we're doing something right. Thank you so much from the bottom of our gnomish hearts.
Gnomecast is hosted by Misdirected Mark Productions, the media arm of Encoded Designs.
This is line one, line one, line two, line two, line two. Line one, line one, line one, line both, line both, line both. It's a test.